A heavy silence fell between us. I wanted to protest and say what people say when they're given an expensive gift. I can't accept it, which also means I am not worthy of your gift. But I knew this would offend him. I still think our discovery is too neat, too easy, I said. Part of me doesn't trust it. Let's not rush to conclusions yet. Why not? Because I can't think of a single reason why a well-to-do young Catholic man from the Lycée J, whose parents probably subscribe to the Action Française, would want to touch the Col Nidre. So what are you saying? That our Léon may not be Léon Deschamps. In my attempt not to leave any stones unturned, I spent the whole of the following week looking for clues. There were more dead ends and another false start. But then, that Saturday afternoon in his country house, it suddenly hit me. Something kept gnawing at me. First, that your father continued to go to the Saint-Hugh concerts on Sundays. Might the church have been tied in some mysterious way to Léon? Perhaps the church itself also had something to do with the Florian Quartet. I knew that the Florian had been playing for years at that same church, and you yourself told me that your father had subsidized their concerts. So I looked them up online and eventually found out, as I suspected, that there were not one or two, but three incarnations of the Florian. The Florian started in the mid-1920s, not as a quartet, but as a trio. Violin, cello, and piano. And now comes the part that shows I'm a true genius. The pianist of the trio was not Léon Deschamps, as the two of us thought, but someone who had been with the trio for 10 years, who played the piano, but also the violin. His name was Ariel Waldstein. So I looked up Ariel Waldstein, and sure enough, he was a Jewish pianist who didn't just die in the camps, but was beaten to death there, because he owned an Amati violin and refused to part with it. He was 62 years old. But the name Ariel is not Léon, said Michel. I put the puzzle together early this morning. How, I've no idea. In Hebrew, Ariel means Lion of God. In short, Léon. Many Jews have a Jewish and a Latin name. In the 20s, the violinist is listed as Ariel. In the early 30s, he becomes Léon, probably because of rising anti-Semitism. The easiest way to find out more about him is to inquire at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. I felt a need to add something else here, as though all this digging and excavating into the life of Ariel Waldstein were also bringing to light a subject that might seem totally incidental, but that I knew was subliminally related, if only because it involved the passage of time and the rediscovery of a beloved person. I could almost sense where this could head, and was already reluctant to fathom any deeper, for fear that Michel's thoughts were already inclined that way. He didn't bring it up. I didn't either. But I was sure it had crossed his mind. We showered together that Sunday morning, then went out for a short walk, using the back door, which I hadn't seen before. Everyone in the village seemed to know Monsieur Michel, and greetings flew back and forth across the way. He led me to a cafe on the corner of a street that looked as though it had nothing to recommend it, but the moment we stepped inside, I immediately felt warm and sheltered. It was filled with people who had parked their cars or vans to have something hot to drink before getting back on the road. We ordered 2 cups of coffee and 2 croissants. 3 girls in their late 20s were sitting next to us, basically grumbling about the men in their lives. I liked it when Michel, who was eavesdropping, smiled and then winked at me. "Men are terrible," he said to one of the girls. "Horrible. How you men can face yourselves every morning is beyond me." "It's not easy, but we try," said Michel. There was laughter. The waiter who overheard said that women were better than men, and that his wife was the most perfect person in the world. "Why?" asked one of the girls, who kept going through the motions of lighting a cigarette, only to put off doing so.
"Why? Because she made me a better person. And let me tell you, with me, this was something only a saint could accomplish."
"So she is a saint, then?"
Let's not exaggerate. Who wants a saint in bed?
Everyone was laughing. After coffee, Michel extended his legs all the way under the table and seemed majestically satisfied with breakfast.
"Another?" he asked.
I nodded yes. Michel ordered two more coffees. We didn't speak.
"3 weeks," he finally said,
perhaps to fill the silence. I echoed his words. Then from nowhere, he reached out and held my hand. I left it in his, feeling awkward because the place was filled with people who were standing at the bar. He must have sensed my unease and let go.
"Tonight they're playing Beethoven again."
He was saying it as though tacitly trying to coax me into going. "I thought we had a date."
"Well, I didn't want to presume," he said.
"Stop!" "I can't help it." "But why?"
"Because the young teenager still lingers inside me and occasionally utters a few words, then ducks and goes into hiding. Because he's afraid of asking. Because he thinks you'll laugh that he asked. Because even trusting is difficult. I'm shy, I'm scared, and I'm old."
"Don't think this way. We've almost solved a mystery today. What we need to do is ask the cellist tonight if he remembers Ariel. He may not, but all the same, we'll ask."
"Will it bring my father back?"
"No, but it might make him happy, which will make you happy." He considered my words for a moment, then shook his head as he'd done before to signify resigned and quiet comprehension. Then, as though he'd jumped across all the unstated subjects between us, "Can you promise that you'll play the cadenza? One day soon, I hope." "I'll play it late this coming spring, when I tour the States, and in the fall when I'm back in Paris. I promise." I saw him hesitate, and I realized why. Now was the time to tell him. "In America, I'm planning to drop in on someone I haven't seen in ages." I watched him ponder the matter.
"So you're traveling solo then?"
I nodded. Again, I watched him weigh my words. "The marriage, canard?" he finally asked. I nodded. I loved that he was able to read me so well, yet I feared what he was reading. "Being with you reminds me of him," I said. "If I meet him, the first thing I'll want to do is to tell him about you."
"What, that I fall short of such a high standard?"
"No, because you and he are the standard. Now that I think of it, there's only been the two of you. All the others were occasionals. You have given me days that justify the years I've been without him." I looked at him, and this time it was I who reached out and held his hand. "Walk," I said.
"Walk."
We stood up, and he suggested we go back through the wood to reach the lake. "What I think we should do is find out who Ariel Waldstein was. Perhaps there is someone who might know more about him."
"Perhaps, but he was 62 when he died, which puts a living relative at a very, very advanced age."
"So Ariel was probably twice your father's age at the time." He suddenly looked at me and smiled. "You're a snake."
"I wonder about the two of them. Maybe this is what feeds our search in the end." Us, you mean? Maybe. If the church has records, we'll know. We can even try to find Ariel's address, maybe in an old telephone book. And if we do find the building, what we should do is commission a Stolperstein in his name. But what if there are no descendants? What if the line stopped with him? What if there isn't a trace of him, and there is not a thing more to learn? Then we'll have done a good deed. The stone will be a memory of all those who perished and couldn't even smuggle a word of warning, or of love, or even their name, before the gas chamber, except for a score with a Hebrew prayer. Did anyone in your family die in the Shoah? You know about my great-uncles. I also think my great-grandmother died in Auschwitz. But I'm not sure. You die, and then no one speaks of you, and before you know it, no one asks, no one tells. No one even knows or wants to know. You're extinct. You never lived, never loved. Time never casts shadows, and memory doesn't drop ashes. I thought of Ariel. The score was his love letter to a young pianist, his secret missive. Play it for me. Say Kaddish for me. Remember the tune? It's hidden in there, under the Beethoven next to the Mozart. Find me. Who knows under what dreadful, unthinkable conditions Leon the Jew penned his cadenza to say, I am thinking of you. I love you. Play. And I thought of old Ariel the Jew who'd visit Adrian's home, even though he knew he was unwelcome. Ariel seeking refuge but being turned out, or worse yet, denounced either by the father or by the mother or by the servants, probably with the blessing of the parents. I thought of Ariel attempting to flee to Portugal or England, or far worse, Ariel arrested by the French milice during one of those terrifying raids when Jews, young and old, were torn from their homes in the middle of the night and forced into packed trucks. Then Ariel penned up somewhere. Ariel in the cattle cars. Finally, Ariel being beaten to death because he wouldn't part with his violin, which is likely now sitting in a German home with a family who might not even know the instrument was looted after its owner perished in a camp. Was Michel's father perhaps atoning for not having helped to save Ariel? Since I couldn't give you or your loved ones shelter, I'll never play again. Or, after what they've done to you, music is dead to me. I could just hear the older man imploring, but you must play. For the love of me, never stop. Play this, then. And once again I thought of my life. Was there anyone who would send me a cadenza one day and say, I am gone, but please find me, play for me? What is the name of the Jewish prayer? Kol Nidre. Is it recited for the dead? No, that prayer is called the Kaddish. Do you know it? Every Jewish boy learns it. We're taught to rehearse for the death of loved ones before we know what death even is. The irony is that the Kaddish is the only prayer one cannot use on oneself. Why is that? Because you can't recite it and be dead at the same time. You people. We laughed. Then I thought for a moment. You know, there is more than a strong possibility that this whole Leon Ariel thing is nothing more than a fiction. Yes, but it is ours. I know exactly what we'll do tonight. We'll return to the city. I will be like my father, and you'll be the young man I was in those years, or you'll be my son, whom I never see. And we'll sit together and listen to the Florian Quartet, perhaps the way my father did when he was your age and I was Leon's. You know, life is not so original after all. It has uncanny ways of reminding us that even without a god, there is a flash of retrospective brilliance in the way fate plays its cards. It doesn't deal us 52 cards, it deals, say, 4 or 5. And they happen to be the same ones our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents played. The cards look pretty frayed and bent. The choice of sequences is limited. At some point, the cards will repeat themselves, seldom in the same order, but always in a pattern that seems uncannily familiar. Sometimes the last card is not even played by the one whose life ended. Fate doesn't always respect what we believe is the end of a life. It will deal your last card to those who come after, which is why I think all lives are condemned to remain unfinished. This is the deplorable truth we all live with. We reach the end and are by no means done with life, not by a long stretch. There are projects we barely started, matters unresolved and left hanging everywhere. Living means dying with regrets stuck in your craw. As the French poet says, le temps d'apprendre à vivre, il est déjà trop tard. By the time we learn to live, it's already too late. And yet there must be some small joy in finding that we are each put in a position to complete the lives of others, to close the ledger they left open and play their last card for them. What could be more gratifying than to know that it will always be up to someone else to complete and round off our life? Someone who we loved and who loves us enough. In my case, I'd like to think it will be you, even if we're no longer together. It's like already knowing who will be the one who'll shut my eyes. I want it to be you, Elio. For a moment, and just as I was listening to Michelle speak, it occurred to me that there was only one person on this planet that I'd like to have my eyes shut by. And he, I hoped, without saying a word to me for years, would cross the globe to place his palm upon my eyes as I would place mine on his. So, said Michel, we'll meet the oldest member of the quartet, the one you were keen on hearing 3 weeks ago, and we'll ask if he remembers. But before that, during the break, we'll buy hot cider from the decrepit old nun. Maybe pretend again that we don't know each other. Promise to meet after the concert, knowing that afterward we'll head out for a little snack. God, did I tell you how much I wanted you to hold me and ask me to come home with you that night? I was almost on the point of saying something, but then I held back. Perhaps it wasn't in the cards that night. He smiled. Perhaps not. He looked at me while wrapping his scarf around his neck. Are you cold? He asked. A bit, I said. I could tell he was feeling apprehensive about me, but didn't want to show it. Want to go back home instead? I shook my head. I get cold when I'm nervous. Why are you nervous? I don't want this to end. Why should it? No reason. You are the one card I was almost cheated of in this lifetime. Tonight it will be 3 weeks, and it could so easily have not happened at all. I need, but then he stopped. You need? I need another week, another month, another season, meaning another lifetime. Give me winter. Come spring, you'll fly away on tour. Beneath all the layers we uncovered today, I know there is one person for you, and I don't believe it's me. I did not say anything. He smiled wistfully. The marriage canard, perhaps. Then he balked for a moment, and I heard his voice tighten. The one thing I want in this life is for you to find happiness. The rest. He couldn't finish his sentence. He shook his head to mean that the rest didn't matter. Neither of us had anything to add. I held him and he held me, and we were still holding each other when he spotted a skein of geese flying overhead. Look, he said. I did not release my hold. November, I said. Yes. Not winter, not fall. I've always liked November in Coro country. Capriccio. Erica and Paul. They had never met before, yet both stepped out of the same elevator together. She was wearing high heels, he boat shoes. Riding to my floor, they'd discovered they were headed to the same apartment, and that they even knew someone in common, a certain Clive, about whom I knew nothing whatsoever. How they managed to arrive at Clive struck me as strange, but then why find anything strange on an evening that already promised to be strange, since the two persons I so desperately wanted to see at my farewell party had, in fact, arrived together. He came with his significantly older boyfriend, she with her husband, and I still couldn't believe that after months of wanting to draw closer to the two of them, I finally had them both under my roof on my last few days in the city. There were many others present, but who cared about the other guests? His partner, her husband, the yoga instructor, the friend Nicole kept saying I had to meet, the couple I befriended last fall at a conference on Jewish expatriates from the Third Reich, the peculiar acupuncturist from 10H, the crazy logician from my department along with his nutty vegan wife, and sweet Dr. Chaudhry from Mount Sinai, who'd been happy to reinvent the very concept of finger food tonight to accommodate the guests. At some point, we uncorked the Prosecco and everyone drank to our return to New Hampshire. The speeches echoed in the already empty apartment, and a few graduate students toasted and roasted me with affection and humor as more guests kept coming and going. But the two who mattered stayed. There was even a moment as people were milling around the barren apartment when she stepped out onto the balcony and I followed, then he followed, and the two of them leaned against the banister with flutes in hand, talking about this man Clive, she at my left, he at my right, while I set my glass down on the floor and put my arms around each of their waists. Friendly, casual, totally okay. Then I removed my arms and leaned against the balustrade, all three of us shoulder to shoulder, watching the setting sun together. Neither shifted away from me. Both were leaning into me. It had taken months to bring them here. This was our quiet moment, on the balcony overlooking the Hudson on this unusually warm mid-November evening. His department at the university was on the same floor as mine, but we had no academic dealings with each other. From the looks of him, I assumed he was either a graduate student finishing his dissertation, or a recent postdoc, or an early tenure-track assistant professor. We shared the same stairway and the same floor, occasionally crossed paths at large faculty meetings, or more commonly at Starbucks, two blocks down Broadway. Usually late in the afternoon before graduate seminars started. We'd also noticed each other when we met a few times in the same salad bar across the street, and then couldn't avoid smiling when we ran into each other after lunch to brush our teeth in the same bathroom. It became a standing source of smiles when the two of us met on our way to the men's room with our toothpaste already spread on our brushes. Neither, it seemed, brought his tube to the bathroom. One day he looked at me and said, Aquafresh? And I said, yes. How did he know? By the stripes, he replied. And so to seize his opening, I asked which brand he used. Tom's of Maine. I should have known. He was definitely a Toms of Maine type. Probably used Toms deodorant, Toms soap, other non-mainstream products mostly found in health food stores. Sometimes after watching him rinse out the toothpaste, I wanted to know how fennel after salad tasted in his mouth. We weren't courting each other, but an implicit something seemed to hover between us. Our frail pontoon bridge was built over shy afternoon pleasantries and then hastily dismantled the next morning with scarcely a greeting when we happened to take the same stairway. I wanted something, and I suspect he did too. But I was never sure I'd read the situation clearly enough to say anything or move things farther along. During one of our brief exchanges, I took the opportunity to tell him that I was coming to the end of my sabbatical and would soon be moving back to New Hampshire. He said he was sorry to hear this. He'd meant to sit in on my seminar about the pre-Socratics. But time, he said. Time, mingling an awkward, apologetic smile with a modest sigh. So he'd looked me up and knew about my seminar on the pre-Socratics. This was flattering. He was on deadline for his book on the Russian pianist Samuel Feinberg. I had never heard of Feinberg before and felt it added another side to him I wished I'd taken the time to know better. If he was free and wanted to come for a small farewell reception in our nearly empty apartment, there were no more than 4 chairs left, I said. He'd be more than welcome. Would he? Definitely, he said. His reply came so quickly I was tempted not to believe him. Then there was Erica. We were in the same yoga class. Sometimes she was there unusually early, 6 a.m., as was I. Sometimes the two of us showed up very late, at 6 p.m. There were even times when we came twice on the same day, at 6 a.m. and at 6 p.m. Almost as though we'd been looking for each other, but knew better than to hope to meet twice on the same day. She liked her corner, and I was always a foot away. Even when she wasn't there, I liked to lay my mat on the floor about 4 feet out from the wall. At first, it was because I liked our usual spot. Later, I found subtle ways of saving her spot for her. But neither of us was a regular, which was why it took ages to exchange so much as a hasty nod. Sometimes when I was already lying down with my eyes shut, I would suddenly hear someone drop a mat next to mine. Without looking, I knew who it was. Even when she approached our narrow corner on bare feet, I'd learned to recognize her stealthy, timid swish, the sound of her breathing, the way she'd cleared her throat when she'd lain down. She made no secret of acting surprised, yet pleased to see me there. I was more circumspect and would pretend to do a double take with a sudden, "Oh, it's you, look." I didn't want to be obvious, nor give the impression that I was either eager to connect beyond what had always been light, perfunctory yoga chit-chat whenever we gathered outside the studio with our shoes off, waiting for the earlier group to vacate the room. There was something always civil, yet mildly ironic when we discussed our mediocre performance in class, or complained about the bad substitute teacher, or sighed, wishing each other a pleasant weekend after hearing a stormy weather forecast. We both knew that none of this was going anywhere, but I liked her slim feet and her smooth shoulders gleaming with a summer's tan that seemed to resent letting the scent of last weekend's sunscreen wear off. Above all, I liked her forehead, which was not flat, but rounded, and which hinted at thoughts I couldn't put into words, but wanted to know better, because there was a wry afterthought visibly floating on her features every time she flashed a smile. She wore tight clothes with her lean calves exposed, so that if I allowed my mind free rein, I could easily imagine her legs raised 90 degrees in a Viparita Karani pose, with her heels resting against my chest, toes reaching my shoulders, ankles cupped in my hands as I knelt, facing her. Then if she'd bend her legs and gradually tuck her knees around my waist, all I would need was to hear her breathe and utter a moan, to know that what I wanted was more than just yoga fellowship. I was thinking of inviting our yoga teacher for a farewell evening, I said. Would she and her husband like to join us? That would be great, she said. So here they both were. It was warm for November, and our French windows were wide open, and a breeze from the river kept wafting across the room, while candles flickered on the windowsills, and all of us felt we were in a movie, spending the most enchanted Saturday evening where not a thing goes wrong. All I did was introduce people to people and pose questions, deftly, so nothing I asked might sound like those hackneyed, typically rehearsed host questions, if I sensed that a conversation was drying up. What did you make of the final scene in the movie? What did you think of those two aging actors? Did you like the movie as much as the director's previous one? I find myself liking movies that suddenly end with a song. Do you? It was my farewell party, but I was still the evening's host. I made sure the Prosecco kept flowing freely and everyone seemed completely relaxed. You could see it in the way the two were leaning against the wall and chatting, and when I'd occasionally join them, I felt we were a band apart. If everyone had left the room, we wouldn't have noticed and would have gone on talking about this or that book, this movie or that play, every subject flowing into the other with never a disagreement. They asked questions, too, of me, of each other, and once or twice would turn to those who'd approached us by the kitchen to draw them into the conversation. We burst out laughing, and I held their hands, and I know they both liked that I'd done it. And they responded with a gentle squeeze of their own that was neither lax nor merely politely reciprocal. At some point he, and later she, rubbed my back, delicately, almost as if they also liked the feel of my sweater and wanted to feel it again. It was an amazing evening. We were drinking, our cell phones had not rung once, and Dr. Chaudhry's dessert would start coming out soon. The party had been supposed to end at 8:30, but it was well past that, and no one gave a sign of wanting to leave. Occasionally, I would sneak a glance at Nicole, meaning, "Things okay at your end?" To which a hasty nod would mean, "Yes, all okay at yours?" "Good enough here," I'd respond. We were a perfect team, and being a team is what had kept us together. It was why I think we'd always known we'd make a good couple. Teamwork. Yes. And sometimes passion. "What's with these two?" she signaled with an inquiring tilt of her head, meaning the two young guests she'd never seen before. "Tell you later," I signaled back. She looked pinched and a bit suspicious. I knew that killjoy look that said, "You're up to something." The two had a sense of humor and laughed quite a bit, sometimes at my expense, since I was seldom up to date with things everyone else seemed to know. But I let them have their fun. At some point, Erica interrupted and whispered, "Don't look now, but your wife's friend keeps staring at us. She's interested in a job at the university, which is why I've been avoiding her." "Not interested?" he asked, a smidgen of irony in his voice. "Or not convinced," she threw in. "Not impressed," I replied. What I meant to say was not attracted. "She's pretty, though," Erica said. I shook my head with a derisive smile. "Quiet, she knows we're talking about her." All three of us looked sheepishly away. "Plus, her name is Kieran," I added. "Not Kieran, it's Karen," he said. I heard Kieran. "Actually, she did say Kieran," said my yoga partner. "But that's because she speaks Michiganda." You mean Michiganese? Sounds mashuga. We burst out laughing. We couldn't seem to control ourselves. We're being watched, he said. As we were still trying to muffle our laughter, my mind raced ahead of me. I wanted them in my life, and under any conditions. I wanted them now, with his boyfriend, her spouse, whatever, with their newborns or adopted children if they had them. They'd be welcome to come and go as they pleased, just be in my humdrum, ever so boring day-to-day life in New Hampshire. And what if Erica and Paul got to like each other in some other unforeseen manner? Which might not be so unforeseen at all. It might even give me a vicarious thrill. The libido accepts all currencies. And vicarious pleasures have an over-the-counter exchange rate that is considered reliable enough to pass for real. No one ever went bankrupt borrowing someone else's pleasure. We go bankrupt only when we want no one. Do you think she could make anyone happy? I asked about my wife's friend, not knowing why exactly I had asked the question. A man like you? He immediately added, as though ready to aim a quick dart, while her sly but tacit smile, following his, told me she might have read the ulterior meaning of my question. Both seemed to agree that I was not the type who was easily made happy. If you only knew how simple are the things I want. Like? She asked, almost too abruptly, as though eager to catch me waffling or fibbing. I can name two. Name them then, she said, challenging me on the spot without realizing that she had spoken too hastily, and that my answer, clearly hanging on the tip of my tongue, wasn't what she expected at all. Noticing I hesitated, he said, maybe he doesn't want to answer. Perhaps I do, I replied. Again, a rueful smile quivered on her lips. Perhaps not. So now she knows. She must know. I could tell I was making her nervous. But this, I knew from experience, was the moment when the bold question is asked. It doesn't even need to be asked because the answer can only be yes. But she was nervous. Most of our wants are imaginary anyway, aren't they? I said, trying once more to soften what I just said to give her an out in case she was looking for one and couldn't find it. And some of our fondest desires end up meaning more to us unrealized than tested, don't you think? I don't think I've ever waited long enough to know what delayed desires are. He burst out laughing. I have, she said. I looked at them and they looked at me. I liked awkward moments like these. Sometimes all I needed was to draw them out and not rush to nip them in the bud. But the tension was rising and she hastened to say something, anything, which also told me she had indeed intuited what I wasn't saying. I'm sure there must have been someone who bruised you once or scarred you. There was, I replied. Some people leave us scuttled and damaged. I thought a while. In my case, I'm the one who did the scuttling, yet I'm the one who never recovered. Has she? I hesitated a moment. He, I corrected. Where? Italy. Italy, of course. They do things differently there. She is clever, I thought. Erica and Paul. So yes, they did get along. I let them talk and walked over to some of the other guests. I even joked a bit with Nicole's friend, who, despite the birthmark, was not without beauty and a lively sense of irony, which told me she was a gifted and talented aspiring critic. For a fleeting moment, my mind traveled back to all the weekends during the last academic year when friends from the university would come for our usual informal Sunday dinner. We'd have our traditional chicken pot pie, the quiches, both bought and ready to be warmed, plus my signature cabbage salad with all kinds of ingredients thrown in. Someone always brought cheeses and someone else dessert. And there'd be lots of wine and good bread. We'd talk about Greek triremes and Greek fire and about Homeric similes and Greek rhetorical figures in modern authors. I'll be losing all this, the way I'd lose my small New York rituals, acquired without my knowledge, and that I'd learned to miss when I was elsewhere. I'd lose my colleagues and my new friends, to say nothing of the two of them as well, especially now that we'd learned to be informed with each other outside of yoga and the academy. I looked around now and saw that the place was as empty as when Nicole and I moved in last August. A table, four chairs, a few weather-beaten deck chairs, a sideboard, empty bookcases, a sunken sofa, a bed, closets with countless hangers dangling like stuffed birds with their wings stretched out, and that desolate grand piano that neither Nicole nor I had ever even touched, and that was still piled with the playbills we kept promising to take back to New Hampshire, but already knew we never would. Everything else was already packed and shipped. The university had extended our stay until mid-November, which was when the next tenant, also in the classics department, was due to arrive. Maynard and I had been in graduate school together, and I had already written him a welcoming note. The dryer takes too long, and the Wi-Fi is unreliable. I'd never envied him. Now I'd trade his lot for mine in a second. Eventually, and just as I predicted, the two started talking about Clive the journalist again, whose last name neither of them remembered. Paul was wearing a bleached white short-sleeve linen shirt with the chest button wide open. When he raised his elbow and brought his hand to his head to recall Clive's surname, I could see the skin of his arm all the way up to the scantiest tuft of hair under his arm. He probably shaves there, I thought. I loved his glistening wrists, so thoroughly tanned. I could just see myself spending the rest of the evening trying to catch him raising his hand to his head the next time he'd try to remember someone's name. On occasion, I'd catch him exchanging an elusive and hasty glance with his boyfriend across the room. Collusion and solidarity. Something sweet in the way they seemed to look out for each other. She had come wearing a loose sky blue blouse. I couldn't quite stare at her chest because its contour was just subtle enough not to be provocative, but I knew she was aware each time I looked. I'd never seen her except in yoga clothes. It was her dark eyebrows and large hazel eyes that drew me. They didn't just stare at you. They asked something of you, and then lingered as though actually expecting an answer, to which your speechless blank stare spelled a failure to respond. They weren't quite asking anything either. They had the look of total familiarity of someone who remembers you and is trying to place where from, and the suggestion of a jeer in her eyes was just her way of saying you weren't helping her remember because she could tell you remembered but were pretending not to. There was, and I'd been noticing it too often, something implied each time her eyes strayed to me. It had almost made me break the silence between us once when I saw her waiting in line at a movie theater. She was with her husband, saying something to him, when suddenly she turned and looked at me, and for a brief moment neither of us stopped staring until we both recognized each other, did some silent backpedaling, and simply flashed a silent nod hello, meaning, yoga, right? Yes, yoga. Then we let our gazes scamper away. Meanwhile, Nicole and the yoga teacher decided to step out onto the balcony to light cigarettes. He was making her laugh. I liked hearing her laugh. She seldom laughs. We seldom laugh. I bummed a cigarette from one of the other guests and joined them. We've packed away all our ashtrays, my wife explained, holding a half-emptied plastic glass, on the rim of which she tapped the ashes of her cigarette. No willpower, said the yoga instructor about himself. None here either, she responded, both of them laughing now, as he reached for her cup and tapped his ashes. We chit-chatted a while longer until something totally unexpected happened. Someone had opened the piano and was already playing what I instantly recognized as a piece attributed to Bach. When I stepped back into the room, the crowd had huddled around the piano to listen to what I should have guessed but didn't want to guess was Paul playing. For a moment, and perhaps because I wasn't expecting it, I was transfixed on the spot. We had already shipped the rugs back, and the sound was far clearer, richer, and it echoed in the vacant apartment almost as though he were playing in a large but totally emptied basilica. Why hadn't I known that he'd actually be tempted by this relic of a piano, or that he'd play a piece I hadn't heard in many years? It went on for a few minutes, and all I wanted was to come behind him and hold his head and kiss him on his exposed nape and ask him to please, please play it again. No one seemed to know the piece, and after Paul finished, a respectful silence fell over the room. His boyfriend eventually broke through the crowd and placed a very gentle hand on his shoulder, probably to ask him to stop playing. Except that Paul suddenly broke out into a Schnittke piece that made everyone laugh. No one knew this piece either, but they all laughed when he right away started playing a madman's rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody. Midway through his playing, I had decided to sit on the metal casing covering one of the radiators below a windowsill, and Erica came to sit next to me, quietly, like a cat looking to snuggle into a tight spot on a mantelpiece without disturbing or displacing the china. All she did was turn around looking for her husband, and as she did so, let her right elbow lean on my shoulder. He was standing at the other end of the room, holding a wine glass in both hands, looking uneasy. She smiled at him. He nodded back. I wondered about them. But after turning to face the piano player, she did not remove her elbow from my shoulder. She knew what she was doing. Bold, but undecided. But I could focus on nothing else. I admired the carefree ease with one's body that comes from a confident disposition that is used to finding good fellowship everywhere. It reminded me of my younger days when I, too, assumed that others not only wouldn't mind, but actually hoped I'd reach out to touch them. My gratitude for such carefree trust made me reach for the hand closest to my shoulder. I gave it a light, momentary squeeze to thank her for her friendship, knowing that my reaching for her hand would displace the elbow. She didn't seem to mind at all, but soon her elbow withdrew. Nicole, who'd been in the kitchen, had come to stand next to the radiator and placed her hand on my other shoulder. How different from Erica's elbow. Paul's boyfriend told him it was time to stop playing, as they had to leave soon. Once he starts playing, there's no stopping, and then I have to be the bully who breaks up the party. At that point, I stood and came up to Paul, who was still at the piano, put my arm around him, and said that I had recognized the Arioso by Bach, and that I had no idea he was going to play it. I didn't know it either, he said, his own sense of surprise at once so disarmingly candid and confiding. He was pleased that I recognized Bach's Capriccio. It's a piece Bach wrote on the departure of his beloved brother. You're leaving, so it's not without meaning. If you want, I can play it again for you. What a sweet man, I thought. It's because you're leaving, he repeated, and everyone heard, and the sheer humanity in the tone of his voice tore something out of me that I couldn't show or express
among so many guests. So once again, he played the arioso, and he was playing it for me. And everyone could see he was playing it for me. And what broke my heart was that I knew, as he must have known, that what is so dreadful about farewells and departures is the near certainty that we'll never see each other again. What he didn't know, and couldn't have known, was that this same arioso was what I'd heard played for me some 20 years before, when, then too, I was the one departing. "Are you listening to his playing?" I asked the one person who was absent but never absent for me. "I'm listening." "And you know, you do know I've been floundering all these years." "I know. So have I. What lovely music you used to play for me. I wanted to." "So you haven't forgotten?" "Of course I haven't." And while Paul played and I stared at his face and couldn't let go of his eyes that were staring back at me with such unguarded grace and tenderness that I felt it in my gut, I knew that some arcane and beguiling wording was being spoken about what my life had been, and might still be, and might never be, and that the choice rested on the keyboard itself and me. Paul had just finished playing Bach's arioso when he immediately explained that he had decided to play a choral prelude as transcribed by Samuel Feinberg. "Less than 5 minutes, I promise," he said, turning to his partner. "But this tiny choral prelude," he said, interrupting his playing before picking it up again, "can change your life." "I think it changes mine each time I play it." Was he speaking to me? How could he possibly have known about my life? But then, he must have known. And I wanted him to know. How music could change my life meant something irreducibly clear the moment he had spoken these words to me. And yet I already sensed that the words themselves would elude me in a matter of seconds, as though their meaning were permanently bound to music. To an evening on the Upper West Side when a young man introduced me to a piece of music that I had never heard before and now wished I'd never stop hearing. Or was it the autumnal night made brighter with the Bach? Or was it the loss of this hollowed-out apartment filled with people I'd grown to like and liked even more now because of the consolations of music? Or was music just a premonition of this thing called life? Life made more palpable, life made more real, or less real, because there was music and incantation trapped in its folds. Or was it his face? Just his face when he had looked up at me from his chair and had said, "If you want, I can play it again for you." Or perhaps what he might have meant was this. If the music doesn't change you, dear friend, it should at least remind you of something profoundly yours that you've probably lost track of, but that actually never went away, and still answers when beckoned by the right notes, like a spirit gently roused from a prolonged slumber with the right touch of a finger and the right silence between the notes. "I can play it again for you." Someone had spoken similar words 2 decades before. "This is the Bach as transcribed by me." As I looked at Erica sitting next to me on the radiator casing and at Paul at the piano, I also wanted their lives to be changed because of tonight. Because of the music, because of me. Or perhaps all I wanted was for them to bring back something from my past. Because it was the past. Or something like the past, like memory, or maybe not just memory, but tiers and layers deeper, like life's invisible watermark that I still wasn't seeing. Then once again his voice. "It's me, isn't it? It's me you're looking for, me," the music summons up tonight. I looked at the two and could tell they hadn't a clue. I myself didn't have a clue. I could already see how the bridge between the three of us was destined to remain fragile and would so easily be dismantled and drift downstream after tonight. And all the amity and cheer fostered by Prosecco music and Dr. Chaudry's finger food would dissipate. Things might even regress to what they'd been before we discussed toothpastes or laughed at the mean yoga instructor whose breath, incidentally, was positively foul, wasn't it? She'd said once, as soon as we'd had a moment together after class. Now, while Paul played, I thought of our home in New Hampshire and how distant and sad everything there seemed. As I looked out and faced the nightscape on the Hudson and thought of the furniture that we'd need to uncover once we were home, and the dusting and airing of the house, and all those hasty weekday dinners sitting face to face alone, now that the boys were away in school. We were close, yet distant too. The reckless fire, the zest, the mad laughter, the dash to Arrigo's night bar to order fries and two martinis. How quickly they'd vanished over the years. I had thought marriage would bring us together, and that I'd turn over a new leaf. I'd thought that living without children in New York would bring us together again. But I was closer to the music, to the Hudson, to the two of them, about whom I knew not a single thing, and couldn't care a whit about their lives, their Clives, their partners or husbands. Instead, as the choral prelude filled the room and grew a touch louder, my mind drifted elsewhere, as it always does when I've had a bit to drink and hear a piano cutting through an ocean and seas and years, away to an old Steinway played by someone who, like a spirit beckoned by Bach tonight, hovered in this barren living room to remind me we're still the same. We haven't drifted. This was how he always spoke to me in such moments. We're still the same. We haven't drifted, with a jeering languor inflecting each of his features. He had almost said it 5 years ago when he'd come to see me in New Hampshire. I tried to remind him each time that he has no reason to forgive me. But he utters an impish laugh, shoos away my protestations, and never angry, smiles, takes off his shirt, sits on my lap in his shorts, his thighs straddling mine and his arms tight around my waist while I'm trying to focus on the music and the woman next to me, and raising his face to mine as though about to kiss my lips, whispers, "You fool. It takes two of them to make one of me. I can be man and woman. Or both, because you've been both to me. Find me, Oliver. Find me." He's visited me many times before, but not like this, not like tonight. "Say something, please tell me something more I want to say." I could, if I let myself, warm up to him with guarded words and reach out with diffident steps. I've drunk enough tonight to believe he'd love nothing more than to hear from me. The thought thrills me, and the music thrills me, and the young man at the piano thrills me. I want to break our silence. "You've always spoken first. Say something to me. It's almost 3 a.m. where you are. What are you doing? Are you alone? Two words from you and everyone's reduced to a stand-in, including me, my life. My work, my home, my friends, my wife, my boys, Greek fire and Greek triremes, and this little romance with Mr. Paul and Miss Erica, everything becomes a screen until life itself turns into a diversion. And all there is you. All I think of is you. Are you thinking of me tonight? Did I wake you?" He doesn't answer. I think you should talk to my friend Karen, said Mikol. I crack a joke at Karen's expense. I also think you've had enough to drink, she snaps.
And I think I'll have some more, I said, turning to speak with the married specialists on Jewish expatriates from the Third Reich, and without knowing how it happened, began to laugh. What on earth were these two doing in my soon-to-be ex-home? Holding another glass of Prosecco, I did walk up to and speak with Mikol's friend, but then seeing the scholars on Jewish expatriates from the Third Reich, I found myself laughing again. Obviously, I'd had too much to drink. I was thinking of my wife again and of my boys away in school. At home, every day, she'll sit finishing her book. Then she'll let me read it, she says. When we're back in our small college town wearing snow boots all through the school year, teaching in snow boots, going to the movies in snow boots, to dinners, to faculty meetings, to the bathroom, to our bed in snow boots. And all of this tonight will be a thing from another era. Erica, a thing of the past, and Paul, locked in the past as well, and I'll be no more than a shadow. Clutching to this very wall that won't see me tomorrow. Still not letting go. Like a fly struggling against the draft that must whoosh it away. Would they remember? Paul asked why I was laughing. I must be happy, I said. Or it's too much Prosecco. Me too. It made the three of us laugh. I remembered that after the Arioso and the choral prelude, after the endless toasts and all the Prosecco, there had been a moment of awkwardness when I helped Erica find her cardigan in the guest room. Two of the guests had already left. The others had congregated in the hallway, waiting. We were alone in the room, and as I told her how happy I was that she had come, I could have let the silence between us last a little longer. I sensed her unease, but knew she wouldn't have minded a few more seconds of this. But I decided not to push things any further, and instead found myself kissing her goodbye on her exposed neck instead of her cheek. She smiled. As I smiled, my smile was apology, hers forbearance. When it came time to bid him goodbye, I made a gesture to shake his hand, but he embraced me even before my hand touched his. I liked his shoulder blades when we hugged. Then he kissed me on both cheeks. His boyfriend kissed me the same way as well. I was pleased, thrilled, and crushed. I stood at the door and watched all four of them walk down the corridor. I'd never see them again. What had I wanted from them? For them to like each other so I could sip more Prosecco and then decide whether or not to join their party? Or had I liked them both and couldn't decide which of the two I wanted more? Or did I want neither but needed to think I did, because otherwise I'd have to look into my life and find huge, bleak craters everywhere, going back to that scuttled, damaged love I'd told them about earlier that evening. Mikol and her friend Karen were cleaning up in the kitchen. I told them to leave the dishes alone. Karen reminded me point blank that she'd like to speak to me again. Maybe soon, she said. As soon as I'm back in the city, I said. I lied. Mikol walked her to the elevator, then came back, meaning to help tidy up a bit before turning in. I told her not to bother. Nice party, she said. Very nice. So who were those two? Kids. She gave me a knowing smile. I'm going to bed. Are you coming? I had cleaning up to do, I said, but I'd join her soon enough. I took my time putting some of the plastic dishes into two contractor bags left over from our packing, and as I was about to turn off the lights in the living room, I found a pack of cigarettes on the side table near the only ashtray in the apartment, probably Karen's. I took one out of the pack, lit it, turned off all the lights, put the ashtray next to me on the old sofa that was no longer ours, put my feet up on one of the four chairs that would stay behind with their new masters, and began thinking of the Arioso as I remembered hearing it so long ago. Then in the semi-darkened living room, I looked out and caught the full moon. My God, how beautiful it was. And the more I stared at it, the more I longed to speak to it. "Didn't change your life, did I?" says good old Johann Sebastian. Afraid not. And why not? Music doesn't give answers to questions I don't know how to ask. It doesn't tell me what I want. It reminds me that I may still be in love, though I'm no longer sure I know what that means, being in love. I think about people all the time, yet I've hurt many more than I've cared for. I can't even tell what I feel, though feel something I still do, even if it's more like a sense of absence or loss, maybe even failure, numbness, a total unknowing. I was sure of myself once. I thought I knew things, knew myself. And people love that I reached out to touch them when I blustered into their lives and didn't even ask or doubt that I mightn't be welcome. Music reminds me of what my life should have been, but it doesn't change me. Perhaps, says the genius, music doesn't change us that much, nor does great art change us. Instead, it reminds us of who, despite all our claims or denials, we've always known we were and are destined to remain. It reminds us of the mileposts we've buried and hidden and then lost, of the people and things that mattered despite our lies, despite the years. Music is no more than the sound of our regrets put to a cadence that stirs the illusion of pleasure and hope. It's the surest reminder that we're here for a very short while and that we've neglected or cheated or, worse yet, failed to live our lives. Music is the unlived life. You've lived the wrong life, my friend, and almost defaced the one you were given to live. What do I want? Do you know the answer, Herr Bach? Is there such a thing as a right or wrong life? I'm an artist, my friend. I don't do answers. Artists know questions only. And besides, you already know the answer. In a better world, she'd be sitting next to me on the sofa to my left, and he'd be at my right, an inch away from the ashtray. She kicks off her shoes, puts her feet up next to mine on the coffee table. My feet, she finally says, sensing we're all staring at them. Ugly feet, aren't they? She says. Not ugly at all, I say. I'm holding their hands. I free one hand, but only to let it linger on his forehead. While she leans into my shoulder, he turns around, faces me, then kisses me on the mouth. It's a long, deep kiss. Neither of us minds that she's watching. I want her to watch. The kid kisses well. She says nothing at first. Then, I want him to kiss me too. He smiles at her, and almost climbing over me, kisses her on the mouth. Afterwards, she says she likes the way he kisses. Agreed, I say. But he smells of cigarettes. My fault, I say. You didn't like the smell? He asks. I like it fine, she replies. I kiss her. She doesn't complain that I smell of tobacco. I'm thinking fennel. I want her to taste of his fennel from his mouth to her mouth to my mouth and back to his. Later that night, I went to sleep thinking of the three of us naked in bed. We are hugging, but in the end, the two are curled up against me, each with a thigh on one of mine. How easily it might have happened. And so naturally, as though both had come to dinner with little else in mind. Why so many schemes? And so much planning and such anxieties when hours earlier I was standing the bottles in buckets of ice. I love the thought of his sweat and hers mingled with mine. Yet all I ended up focusing on was their Achilles tendons. Hers, when she'd removed her shoes and put both feet on the coffee table. His, when he walked in at the very start of the evening and I spotted him wearing boat shoes without socks. I had no idea how slim and smooth and delicate his feet were. Later, he too had taken off his shoes before placing both feet on the coffee table, one slim, tanned ankle over the other. "Look at mine," he'd said, twitching the toes of one foot. We laughed. "Boy's feet," she said. "I know," he replied. Once again he moved closer, placed a knee on my thigh and kissed me. I don't recall what I dreamed that night, but I know that all through the night and through countless flushed and fitful reawakenings, I had loved the two of them, together or separately, I couldn't tell, because there was something so thoroughly real in their unhindered presence in my arms, that when I woke in the middle of the night clutching my wife, I felt, as I'd already imagined earlier that evening, that it wouldn't be far-fetched to start preparing breakfast for the four of us in a kitchen that reminded me of a house in Italy. I thought of Nicole. She had no place in this. Italy was a chapter we never discussed, but she knew. She knew that one day, she just knew, and probably better than I did. I had once wanted to tell her about my old friends and their house by the sea, and of my room there, and about the lady of the house who years ago was like a mother to me, but who now had dementia and hardly remembered her own name, and about her husband who, before dying, lived in the same house with another woman, who still lives there with a 7-year-old son I'm dying to meet. I need to go back, Miko.
Why?
Because my life stopped there. Because I never really left. Because the rest of me here has been like the severed tail of a lizard that flays and lashes about, while the bodies stayed behind all the way across the Atlantic in that wonderful house by the sea. I've been away for far too long.
Are you leaving me?
I think so.
And the children, too?
I'll always be their father.
And when is this happening?
I don't know. Soon.
I can't say I'm surprised.
I know. That same night after the guests had left and Nicole had gone to bed, I turned off the light in the entrance and was about to shut the French windows to the balcony when I remembered to blow out the candles. I stepped outside, stood facing the river, placed both hands on the banister where I'd stood with Erica and Paul earlier in the evening, and stared out across the water. I liked the lights across the Hudson. I liked the fresh breeze. I liked Manhattan this time of year. I liked the sight of the George Washington Bridge, which I knew I'd miss once I was back in New Hampshire, but that right now, on this night, still reminded me of Monte Carlo when its sparkling lights reached into Italy at night. Soon it would be cold on the Upper West Side, and there would be days of rain,
but the weather always cleared eventually here, and people still milled about on the streets late at night when it was cold in this city that never sleeps.